Michael Eisenberg, who's been a guest of ours before, is author of many books, one entitled The Tree of Life and Prosperity, 21st Century Business Principles from the Book of Genesis. We've spoken with him on the air about that. He's also the author of The Vanishing Jew, a wake-up call from the Book of Esther that looks at Megillat Esther from the perspective of economic philosophy and the struggle for money, power, and control, at least according to Wikipedia. That's what it describes or discusses. And Michael Eisenberg, who's originally from New York, immigrated to Israel and co-founded and is a general partner of Aleph, which is a Tel Aviv-based venture capital firm. And it is a pleasure to welcome you back to JM in the AM.
It's great to be here with you, Nahum. Welcome to Jerusalem.
Thank you very much. In your books, you discuss many different eras of Jewish history. And if I remember our conversations that we had about the books, you compare what we're going through today to other eras of the past. What does today resemble to you most from episodes in Jewish history?
That's a really good question. I'm not sure there's an exact answer to the question. In the book, The Vanishing Jew, I pointed out that the period of the Persian Empire, and particularly the assimilation of Jews in Persia, reminded me a lot of what was going on in the United States in the last 20 and 30 years. Maybe before that, after I wrote the book, I got called in by the chairman of the National Library here, David Bloomberg. He said, do you know how many people moved from Eastern Europe and Russia to North and South America between 1880 and 1910? And I said, no, I didn't. This is a few million people. He said, if you just take kind of the multiplication of the population since then, there should be just from that cohort, you know, 10 to 12 plus million Jews in America. Where are they? There's been no anti-Semitism in North and South America. And he said, assimilation. And so that was kind of the biggest threat. Then there's an awakening. And I think we're right now since October 7th or the massacre of Shemini Atzeret, we're going through a Jewish awakening in the diaspora and in Israel for what it's worth. I think there's a coming together of people. There's a recognition, which you've heard from me in the past. And as I mentioned to you before we came on air, I just heard this from a very prominent Jewish investor in America literally an hour and a half ago in my office in Tel Aviv, where she said, I now realize that the prosperity and the success of Jews in America has a lot to do with the success and the prosperity and the safety of the state of Israel. And I think perhaps the period we're in right now is most similar to the time of Nehemiah, where Nehemiah, who is, of course, the number two in the kingdom of Persia, comes to Jerusalem. Why? Because he hears that the people of Jerusalem are in distress and there's terrorism. And we know that from the book of Nehemiah, Tuvia Amoni and others. And he said there's some economic distress in Jerusalem at the time. And he picks up and says, I'm going to go see how my brothers are doing. I'm going to rebuild the country. And I think this is an incredible opportunity, despite the tragedy, and the tragedy is described in the book of Nehemiah, for the Jews of the world, as well as the Jews of Israel, to come together and build and rebuild this country. We are in a foundational moment of the Jewish people. This is 1948 again. We have a chance to build and rebuild. We can't make little changes.
Can diaspora Jewry do that from the diaspora, or must they be here to do that?
It's a good question. My view on the fact that I think Jewish life is more full here, that I think we need the talents of diaspora Jews in Israel to build and rebuild the countries very much. I understand scale at a level.
I would say a lot of that talent's already moved over here, but okay, I hear you.
Fair enough. I wrote an article not long ago that my time in Yeshiva University, do what at the time was called the Revel Controversy, lost a lot of its great future thinkers about the future. We know a lot of these people in common, Hillel Novitzky, Jeff Sachs.
Meaning because they're in Israel.
Yeah, they moved to Israel.
And I can name a bunch of other categories where our most talented have gone to Israel, including youth work, rabbi work, and a whole bunch of other stuff.
But I think it's fair to say there's still an incredible amount of economic, organizational growth talent in the United States, in particular, and in France as well, in the UK, that should be part of this foundational moment, refounding of the country. And I consider myself incredibly fortunate to be living in Israel at this time. I miss 1948 and I miss 1776 in the United States. But you know, somehow in this period of technology, you know, exploding and this incredible challenge through the tragedy of the massacre and the incredible sacrifice and heroism of all of our children here, that we owe it to everybody to now be a refounding moment for the Jewish people in the state of Israel. And I consider it a tremendous privilege. I pinch myself often to say, what have I done right that I've had kids who, you know, marched off to Gaza and the north and everywhere else to sacrifice like this? I consider just, I have goosebumps just thinking about
it. How do they view it?
One of them has, since he got back from Gaza, basically did not go back to work and said, I'm going to help start a political party to refound this country. And they are all of the mind that this is a foundational moment for the future and are asking what they, can they do to restart the country. And I think, by the way, this is a challenge to young people in college today, young Jewish people today in college in America. It's rough on those college campuses outside of Yeshiva University. I'll argue with deep respect to people at Yeshiva University, a wonderful institution that I learned in, that the challenges or opportunities that they're facing pale in comparison to what the kids are doing here.
Right.
And they should come here and help build the country.
All right, my thoughts are everywhere now, so let me try to focus a bit. Michael Eisenberg is with us. I predicted, it's not fair, I repeated in someone else's name an observation after October 7th that the next prime minister of Israel will be somebody we haven't heard of.
I agree with that.
You do agree with that?
I do. I don't know if it's the next prime minister. I think there'll be a prime minister in the next few years who's unlikely someone who's currently in the political system.
Which fits right into your what you just mentioned in terms of some of the youth getting involved and starting or continuing in existing political parties, but going in a different direction, a futuristic direction, let's put it that way.
You know,
one that hopefully benefits the state of Israel and the nation of Israel in the future.
I chair the largest volunteer organization in Israel called the Shomer HaChadash, which has a youth movement of 22,000 kids. We have moved. We operate in agriculture, protecting agriculture and bringing agricultural volunteers. We're bringing 25,000 people a month to the areas around Gaza and the areas in the north and other areas because the Thailandi workers ran away,
right,
and there aren't Palestinian workers. And so I watch these kids all the time. They are incredible. They are a foundational 1948 generation.
Do you depend on them for security as well?
Yes, 100%. Not only, but right, also partially. But by the way, presence is security.
Right.
Right? That's important
right
to say. And these kids are inspiring and incredible. I share another organization called Nevo, which is for Olim, people who have moved to Israel who work in high tech. And they're from 22 countries around the world. And they are committed to the refounding this country. And they are just incredibly tough-minded, ambitious, aggressive people who are building bridges to Jews all around the world and working on just incredible projects to help refound this country. And I think people don't understand the incredible power in the young people in this country in particular, and the opportunity for young people around the Jewish world to join in for this founding moment. Countries are founded by young people. The United States was founded by 20-somethings.
Right. Douglas Murray just quoted somebody who he said fought in the 67 and 73 war, who said to him that he, meaning the soldier, owes this generation an apology because he just assumed and publicly said that they don't have the mettle, they don't have the wherewithal, the guts, the vision, the dream to do what they did in 67 and 73. And he says, we've seen now since October 7th that he's been completely wrong. And obviously you're echoing the same point. I said after October 7th that I don't know if you remember this speech, on Chol HaMoed Sukkos, days before the October 7th massacre, the Prime Minister of Israel spoke at the UN. And he, I don't know if you remember this speech, but he spoke about how Israel is at the forefront of technology, he went into this whole thing about AI, which of course I didn't understand, so I still don't even, I don't know what AI stands for. But he went into this whole thing about AI, and basically his message was, hop on the train now, right? He's telling these nations, hop on this train now, because it's leaving the station, Israel's in the conductor's seat, the engineer's room, and you don't want to miss the boat, you want to make sure. And I was so uncomfortable. I'm watching this, I'm saying, does he remember what neighborhood Israel's in? And does he remember, you know, what kind of challenge just being a secure nation in that area of the Middle East is? And of course, we know what ended up happening. So number one, I'm curious if that at all, in terms of the way you look at the prime minister, if you thought that he was, you know, a little bit too off message with the realities here, that's number one. And number two, because of your expertise, I'd love to know if since October 7th, there's still accelerated investment in smaller, soon-to-be massive companies in Israel.
Just like in the 20th century, you had nuclear countries and non-nuclear countries, in the 21st century, you're going to have AI, artificial intelligence, and quantum computing countries, and you're going to have non-AI and quantum computing countries. It is that important. It is that important to the future economic success of countries. It is that important to the future military success of countries. There's been a fair amount of AI used in battle. It's been spoken about in, you know, in public, some of it. And it's really important. It's really important to be at the forefront of this. And Israel has the opportunity to be at the forefront of it. Right now, the United States and Silicon Valley is at the forefront of it. Probably number two is China. And I think we're number three right now, which is a decent place to be. I'd like to get ahead of China. It would be useful. But it is critical for economic development. It is critical for the future of the battlefield. It's critical for everything. That having been said, in 2018, you know, I write a weekly Dvartor. I have a weekly Dvartor WhatsApp group. It goes out to a few thousand people in addition to the books. I think it was in 2000, and I can't remember, 16 or 18, on Parshas Akev. I wrote a piece about the Pasuk of Kochiva Utsim Yadi Asali Et HaChayil Hazeh, that the strength of my arm created all this greatness for me. And the intro to it says, I heard the prime minister speak about the superiority of our military, and it worries the hell out of me.
Wow.
Yeah, I can show it to you.
So we really do think alike on many things.
And it worries me because that causes overconfidence in these things. And I think one of the things we've learned from October 7th is that overconfidence is a big problem. Number two, there aren't enough people who challenge the system. And we need turnover in political and military systems that's much faster, that keeps up with the pace of technology. The challenge is based on things that happened. We talked before we came on air about the same problem in Jewish organizations in America. There wasn't enough turnover. And we need younger people to go into these places and challenge operating assumptions because the world is changing. Israel had all the information about what was called Chomat Yericho, right? The Jericho wall that Muslim Hamas planned, but no one could see it because they were blinded. And this happens a lot. These paradigms, what they call here the concepcia, or the concept, shift and people miss them. And AI is one of those shifts that's happening, and kudos to the prime minister for being ahead of it. The Israeli startups are way on this, and that's a good sign. We need much more. There was just a 700 million shekel program announced to bring scientists and researchers to Israel.
From the U.S.?
From the diaspora, wherever, Jewish or not. We want the best people in every field. That's a big deal. We need to be, by the way, three times the size, and it will be. But that's a good start.
And since October 7th, would you say there's been a maintenance of the amount of money being invested in these types of ventures in Israel or not?
I see zero difference between what was going on before and what's going on now. We've raised over $500 million into our portfolio companies from abroad. And there's great interest in Israeli technology.
Michael Eisenberg's here. I got to ask you two things. First of all, it has to be with hundreds of thousands of soldiers in reserve duty for many months. And we spoke with one of them on the air who exited his company while he was up north.
Amit Brandon Kadosh.
Is that who we spoke to? I think that's who we spoke to.
I don't know if it's who we spoke to, but he's one of those guys.
Correct.
He's an incredible guy.
I think that's who we had on the air. And he's describing how he's running his company from the base on his iPhone and how he eventually exited and made all these deals to, you know, to move on from his company. There has to be some type of drop-off. I don't know if it's in personnel or in the acceleration of a company. If so much of the attention that normally would go to building these companies was being, you know, utilized on the front or utilized in army bases north and south.
I'll make a meta point and then I'll get to your specific point. We're at a point in history right now where we should expect for the next bunch of years a lot of uncertainty. There's geopolitical uncertainty. There's wars, you know, the Hamas-Israel wars, the second war after Russia-Ukraine. What's going on in Nigeria is nothing to joke about either. And there's many other places, Pakistan, India, China, Taiwan. There's a lot of uncertainty.
A lot of conflict.
We're in the middle of a big technological revolution also with AI and quantum and a bunch of other things. We're in the middle of the social welfare system most countries breaking down right now. Think about it, right? Social Security is going to go bankrupt in America. That's very, very clear to anyone paying attention. And there are other countries with similar problems. Israel as a society and as a civic populace is very, very good at uncertainty. It's what we thrive in. We're used to this. We have people who take civic responsibility, and that's why when the government disappeared for the first 2 weeks of the war, civilians stepped in and it worked fine. We're good at uncertainty. So the specific point is when these guys went off to fight, our founders, our CEOs were incredible. It was wild to see. Coverage, people worked harder, worked longer hours. They pitched in, they got more efficient. And by the way, they guaranteed them their jobs because that's our responsibility to our children, brothers, sisters who went in to fight. And so even though they got more efficient, when these guys got out of Gaza or wherever it was, they're welcome back. Then they figured out what to do. And so literally, I tell you, not one of our companies missed a beat. And we had one company that had 55% of its employees on reserve duty. They're all kind of huge technological elite people. And they've caught up and made up the time, right? They were delayed for 2 months in that case, but they caught up and made up the time afterwards, worked harder at it. This is a country of resilience. And we have a generation of kids that I've called in various posts the defining generation. They've got this. And it's because of that, it's going to be good. And it'll be bumpy for a while. But because of that, it's going to turn out good.
We mentioned the talent pool that might be available in the diaspora to come to Israel. Do you ever worry, and this is really a loaded question for someone in your background, because we know of how you spend the bulk of your day. Do you sometimes worry that so many collegiates in the United States and in Israel are heading in the direction of trying to figure out a way to make millions or billions of dollars, and that might divert their attention from other more ideal goals that they could be spending time on, whether it's, I don't know, you know, building educational institutions, working in some of the types of the organizations that you mentioned. Do you think that, because now I see in the United States that this next generation, you know, where we would normally draft, excuse the term, I shouldn't use that term in this country, we normally would draft our next teachers and principals and heads of organizations, et cetera, they're going the hedge fund route because they want to make sure that as Orthodox Jews, they have enough money to actually raise a family in the United States. Do you worry about that?
I think the system for Orthodox Judaism in America is broken. I think that's pretty obvious. I just published a piece in Tradition about this. Kids have to think about how they make money and not how they do right. And in Israel, that's not the case. Your education is paid for here by the taxpayer. I don't think there's anything wrong with wanting to make money for what it's worth. I think there's a lot of things right about that.
And a lot of good you could do with it.
Yeah, but not just that. God says to Abraham, Ve'ye bracha. Bracha means material wealth. Right. We know that. And that's how you have
Abraham
influence and power.
Abraham was a wealthy man.
Abraham was a wealthy man, right? And he was laden with gold and silver, et cetera. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. On the contrary, I think there's a lot of good that can come from it. But it needs to be intentional. And it needs to be empowering to other people. And it needs to be uplifting to other people. I question your premise of we need teachers, we need this, we need the other. We need transformation. We need to rethink how we educate kids. We need to rethink how we have all of our systems built that are 20th century systems, and we're living in the 21st century. And more than anything, we need to rethink whether people who want to live in the future and have a real impact, Jews who want to live in the future and have a real impact, should be in the diaspora or they should be in Israel. And I think there's not enough thinking about that. And candidly, I think...
You don't have an opinion about it, do you?
Well, I'll say quite openly to you, I worry about a lot of rabbis in America who are promoting against this. And we
or
know
staying
some of them,
silent at the minimum.
Or staying silent at the minimum. Some are even, I think, actively promoting against it.
I agree with you.
I've heard it myself, and I don't get it. You know, Professor Shalom Rosenberg said, my son likes to quote this when we ever have guests from abroad. I'm not sure I agree with it fully, but my son, who is on his way into the military, says this all the time. He said, it could be that exile used to be a punishment. Today, it's a transgression. It's a chet. And I think there's something to that. And
you have to convince me.
And so we need to ask ourselves, how did we get to the point that rabbis could sit on the sideline, teachers could sit on the sideline, or even actively promote against moving to Israel? It's, as you say in Israel, Zomer Dorsheni. We must question that. I mean, to think about the next century.
Without even knowing it, you're alluding to one of my most famous pre-Pesach rants, because for years now, and my listeners know this, whenever we get close to Shabbos HaGadol, I get on the air and say, rabbis, could you do me a favor? Instead of discussing in your Shabbos HaGadol drasha the shiur for Haroses, which I know is important, believe me, I know it's important, could you talk about how Pesach is in fact a traditional national holiday with a national goal of getting to the land of Israel? Could we focus on that once?
You know, by the way, you talk about Pesach, but Shavuot, I gave a class yesterday to a midrashah here of 50 girls, and you know, Shavuot, which today has become about learning Torah all night. Very beautiful.
Right. No criticism.
I'm in favor.
Right.
I do it myself and teach that night. But it's a holiday of national identity, right? If Pesach is the holiday of going free, of becoming a nation, this is becoming a nation with a land. And that's why you read Ruth on this day, because she comes back with Naomi from Moab to us and says, Amech ami v'elohayech Elohai, your nation is my nation, your God is my God. And the reason we bring the Bikurim, the first fruits, on this day is because it's connected to a land. And the reason that the end of the portion about Shavuot talks about in Hebrew, you need to leave over the corner of your field, and you need to leave over the droppings, what you drop from the wheat for the poor people. That's a national ethos. That's not just have a pushka in the shul. That's a national ethos of connection to land and enabling people to work your field. It's a connection to land. Shavuot is not celebrated properly in diaspora, period, full stop.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to be so passionate about it.
Are you kidding me? I'm glad you're saying all that. Are you kidding me?
And I may have just ruined a lot of rabbis' drushes on Shavuos night. I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, I'm starting with Shabbos HaGadol. I think that's a more obvious one. We'll get to Shavuos eventually because there are all nights urine for 4.5 hours that do focus on some of the minutiae. Again, no criticism. It's important, but you know what I mean. But I think I'm going to start with the Shabbos HaGadol, get them to at least transform that into a message of national unity.
I'll tell you what I'm going to speak about. At least one of the shurim I'm giving on Shavuos night is going to be about what happens when a bank crashes on Shabbos. Are you allowed to be Mechal Shabbos if a bank crashes on Shabbos? And are there differences in the halacha between Israel and the diaspora? I wrote a long 28-page tshuva about this.
I can't even believe this is a question.
Silicon Valley Bank crashed on Shabbos. It was Shabbos in Israel. It wasn't Shabbos in America. What do you do? In March of a year plus ago. It's a question, by the way.
Someone once told me about somebody who was a victim of identity theft on Shabbos.
Yeah.
And they asked the Shiloh if they could, because speed is a very important element when you're trying to defend yourself against identity. So at the minimum, you and I can say it's a Shiloh, right? It's not just a blanket. No, it's a Shiloh, right?
It is a Shiloh. There's a Magen Avraham who talks about Hefsed Gadol.
On Shabbos.
Yeah, I think there's a giant difference, though, between your personal identity theft and a bank crashing on Shabbos. And, for example, how that impacts the high-tech industry here when it's called Silicon Valley Bank. Right. And there's, you know, hundreds of Israeli companies, if not thousands.
And God knows how many people are going to be affected by it.
Yeah, right. I think that's a different question. It's getting a lot of opposition for a variety of reasons, but it's okay. That's how we move halakha forward.
Right. Interesting. Wow. And, of course, all these halachot will likely be very different 50 years from now.
It'll
be viewed differently 50 years from now.
In general, I think halakha doesn't necessarily change, but the application changes and the way we kind of look at the paradigms of what we apply where changes.
So it's interesting. You know, I thought today was an interesting... I'm 2 days in Jerusalem, right? I mean, I'm here more than that, but on the air, I'm 2 days in Jerusalem, and I always think about what the themes of these shows will be. And yesterday was more of I'm here, and again now I have been revisited by the feeling of Jewish tradition that all of us have to be here. And that was my theme yesterday was, you know, visit as often as possible, eventually move here, etc. Okay. So today I said, you know what? With the roster I have walking into this studio, yourself, Rabbi D, both of you have been relatively outspoken on the issue of what on earth are you guys doing outside of Israel?
Like this is a chiddush.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So I was wondering, are you going to get to that point in this conversation where you're simply going to lay down the hammer and say, hey, everybody tuned in, what on earth are you doing in the diaspora portion of this audience?
I didn't need to. You did it. And all I need to, I think I know you probably 40 years.
Yes, at this point.
Probably for 20 of them, I've been asking you the same question.
Correct.
Hoping that you'll use your platform. Didn't hear it. You just did it. Wow.
So it's
Nachum just called Jews around the world, all hundreds of thousands of listeners of Nachum Siegel.
And it's funny.
A beloved figure in all of our lives. He just called on you all to come move to Israel. This is a Nehemiah moment. Nachum Siegel is a modern Nehemiah. Nehemiah.
Oh, in this building, you can't call me a modern Nehemiah. There are some modern Nehemiahs in this
building.
Fair
enough. Fair enough.
But
we'll give you a supporting role if you'd like.
But now I must tell you my joke that I said yesterday. You know,
this is not a joking time.
It's not a joking topic. Okay. But you'll like this one. The guy's sitting at the Pesach Seder and he's screaming, Lashana Bab Yerushalayim, Lashana Bab Yerushalayim. And from the kitchen, he hears, Mendel, not so loud. We just redid the kitchen. So,
true story, I was at a wedding in America. I don't remember how many years ago.
No way.
It was 15, 18 years ago. Yeah. And they're singing, Lashana Bab Yerushalayim, and Rabbi Buchwald grabs me and says, none of them mean it. I said, Rabbi, what are you doing here, Rabbi?
But he's unfortunately probably right.
Listen, I'm hoping something changed. Really, I'm an optimistic guy. You know,
it's such a shame that had to happen through tragedy.
In my venture capital business, you know, you have to be optimistic. And I'm an optimist in general, an optimist about Israel, an optimist about the Jewish people. I'm an optimist about humans in general. Sometimes we need a wake-up call. But you cannot let a wake-up call go unanswered. You know, I called my book, The Vanishing Jew, a wake-up call from the Book of Esther.
Right.
I wrote it in 2015, 2016. Unfortunately, I predicted this moment. Unfortunately. And And
meaning because of the overconfidence in general between the government, military, etc.?
No. Really about American Jewry. About that the rise of anti-Semitism was already underway in 2015 and 16. Right. It hadn't been noticed yet and what the causes of it were. And I'm hoping, I'm praying, and I literally daven about this every day since October 7th with more fervor, which is that people should have their ears open, that people should have their hearts open, that people should be willing to make change. The hardest thing, you know, we say in davening every morning, HaMechadesh B'tuvo B'chayom Tamid Ma'asev Rishis, that God renews his... He goes, actually, people don't believe that. Most people get up tomorrow morning because they think it'll look like today. Change is very hard for people. To change your mental models is hard. To change your activities is hard. Change is hard for human beings. But, when there's a wake-up call of this magnitude, whether it's October 7th in Israel or October 8th on college campuses or in Toronto being shot up or whatever, if you don't, something doesn't change in you, if something doesn't kind of shudder in you and say, you turn to your spouse and say, maybe we should do this differently. Or for a young person, I hope you have young listeners. I hope they're listening. Come, we will help you be successful in Israel. You don't need to go to Wall Street. You can even work for Wall Street from here, but you don't need to go there. You can come here. You will be successful. This is a country, not just with great needs, but with great impact globally. You can access the U.S. market, the Indian market, the European market, the Emirati market. I've spent a lot of times in the UAE since the Abraham Accords. Incredibly welcoming people. A lot of my friends are saying, who would have imagined that you could walk around more safely in Abu Dhabi with the yarmulke than you can at Harvard?
Or right at the Columbia campus.
Okay, or Columbia campus. Yeah. Just come. You will not only do well, you will feel good. I want to tell you a story that happened today also.
Please.
31-year-old young man who went to the University of Pennsylvania. He dropped out to go to the IDF and to Tzanchanim, to the paratroopers. He then went to work at a hedge fund. But he kind of in his heart wanted to kind of change the future of the Jewish people and the state of Israel for good. That was what he wanted to do. And he came to Israel in April of last year, so 13 months ago. And he was sent to see me by a mutual friend. And he had a set of interesting ideas around defense technologies. And I said to him at the time, you need to come spend a year here so you can really figure this out. Just talking about it from Los Angeles where you're living now is not going to solve it. And so he picked up and came. And in June, he moved himself here to an apartment. He's not married. He didn't have a family. He spent the last year doing incredible work and research work. He is now setting up a company that I literally believe can transform the future vector of the state of Israel. This kid, he came from America. He came here 12, 14 months ago. He's wired into this country at the absolute highest levels, 31, at the absolute highest levels. And he just came determined to make a difference to the Jewish people. I walked out. I brought him to meet all my partners today so we would invest. And we're going to invest. And I walked out inspired. And one of my partners turned to me and he said, you know, he's a different kind of guy than we normally run into in Israel. And that kind of difference is going to make this country for the next 50 years. It's like, yeah, he will. You'll remember this kid's name. I won't tell it to you now so people don't bombard him. People will remember this young man's name. And if anybody else is listening and you want to come do that, just come. You can do it. I deeply believe that.
Is there a formal path? Does somebody have to come here and go to a specific institution or
no.
College or degree or anything?
No, this is a country that runs on WhatsApp. One of the things he said today was he's working on something in defense. He said, in America, if you want to get this loan, you got to call a 4-star general and you need to set up a company and come in this. And Israel sent a WhatsApp and everyone responds. I said on David Bashevskin's podcast, civic revolution or civic responsibility, which is where we're headed in the world. Governments around the world are falling and failing. So what's going on? They can't deliver services in the 21st century. So we're moving to an era where civilians take more responsibility for their countries. We have a civilian army. We had a civilian response to October 7th.
Right.
Okay? Our government is hamstrung. It just is. Look around. And this is a powerful civilian economy and a power civilian defense and a powerful civilian responsibility organization. This is where you want to be. And civilians help civilians. That's what we do here. Arvut Hadadit, or mutual responsibility. Kol Yisrael Ariven Zelazeh. You probably have a song like that here somewhere in your background. That's what this country is built on. And it's not a community. It's a country. It's not Teaneck. And it's not Woodmere. And it ain't, you know, Boca Raton. This is a country. This is our country. And you got to be in it to win it. And when you come, people want you to win. And that's an amazing thing.
Wow. What percentage of the people you meet with on a regular basis with new ideas actually move forward after meeting with you in your office? Is it very small or relatively large?
We fund a tiny percentage, less than 1% of what we meet.
So you meet 100 people and only one or two are going to get funded?
0 to 1.
Wow, interesting.
So
would you still say there are a lot of good ideas out there?
Sure. You know, we have a specific model.
You don't always
model.
See the financial potential.
No, we have a specific model of how we invest. So, you know, but there's other things we've looked at that other people have invested in. But the nature of startups is that most of them fail. And I used to, when I started in this business, I kept wondering, why don't I see any yarmulkes in this business? And the reason is that nobody wants to walk into shul and their mother say, oh, that's my kid, he failed. And you know, failure is a big, big part of this business.
Wow.
Everyone fails, but we learn most from failing. You know, yesterday I had lunch with Eyal Shani, the famous chef. Maybe you've been, if you're on the west side of Manhattan, his restaurant on 72nd Street called Malka.
Of course.
He's an incredible chef. I had lunch with him yesterday at his kosher restaurant in Tel Aviv. It was among the most fascinating conversations I've had in the last decade. A brilliant, genius.
Business mind. Just culinary mind.
Business mind, yes. Artistic mind, culinary mind, just a different thinker. A
lot of creativity.
Unbelievable. Like, my mind was blown by him. And I said to him, what's the most powerful force in your creativity? He says, you know, I didn't understand this, but I'll tell you what the most powerful anti-force is, what stops me, success. He says, you get locked into a model because it works. By the way, think about that in the context of October 7th. The model was working until it didn't.
Right.
Right? And he said, success. He said, the most powerful thing that's propelled my restaurant business forward is my failures. And when I see chefs that are failing in my restaurant, I ride them. And I drive the failure further into them so that this creativity and success then bursts forward from it. And I said, wow, that's amazing. And many of the entrepreneurs that we back have failed once or failed twice. And they've learned from it and come back. Sheva Yipol Tzadik Vikam, the tzadik, falls often 7 times and then he stands up. And that's a lesson for our life, is that we need to get up and we become better from it. And when Eyal said this, he said, you know, and the best creativity comes from failure also, because you got to try something radically different in order to make it better. And I walked out of this lunch just inspired. I was inspired spiritually.
The hardest thing to do is stay number one. That's the hardest thing to do.
It's not even about staying number one as much. We don't need to be number one. We need to always be striving to get better and be different. Our slogan at Aleph, at our fund, is different is better than better. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. And I say this about the Orthodox community. We try to stamp out difference way too much. But the greatest Talmidei Chachamim were different.
Right.
The greatest writers were different. The greatest business people and sports, they were different. Stamping out difference is a malaise. And actually just kind of gets us comfortable with where we are. We should never be comfortable. That's what, you know, God said to Avram, it's comfortable in Haran. By the way, it says it, right? The money he made in Haran, it was comfortable. He was a comfortable diaspora Jew in Haran. God said, no. Lech lecha. Get up and go. Move. Make a change. Make a change. And he's the prototypical father of our people. And somehow we don't learn from that. And he was different. He was the only guy running around calling out in God's name in all of Canaan. And by the way, he made a deal with Aner Eshkol Mamre. They weren't Jewish. It's good. He made a defense pact with them. And they had a wayward nephew.
Abraham Accords.
Yeah, the Abraham Accords. That's where it comes from, by the way.
Right.
Yeah. from an incredible general who named it the Abraham Accords. And American general. And that's what we're meant to be. That's what we're meant to be. You know, be uncomfortable. Take yourself out of your comfort zone. Get up and move. Lech lecha. After October 7th, I didn't even stand, wake up in the morning and not say lech lecha. How was Parshas Lech Lecha in America, not the Parsha of Aliyah? How come every rabbi, 3 weeks after October 7th, didn't get up in shul and say, get up and go? How come?
Yeah. Wish I had a good answer. To bring this full circle, by the way, you mentioned about the diaspora Jewry flourishing when Israel flourishes.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the reasons why when we see Israeli soldiers, we thank them for us being able to live in luxury and comfort in diaspora. They never get it. There is not a soldier I've met who I've said it to who chop what I'm talking about. But believe me, we in the diaspora get it.
Yeah, by the way, coming to visit the Kotels also because of those guys when you come on a vacation for Yonta for whatever it is. But yeah. I'll tell you why they don't get it. And this has like been a... I was in shul on October 7th. I've talked about this in a couple of podcasts. I was in shul. It was Simchas Torah morning. I davened very early.
Yerushalayim?
In Yerushalayim. I daven very, very early in the morning, Nates, and we have a short minyan with seven hakafas around the bima. So it was the six hakafa.
You're my kind of guy.
It was the six hakafa when the first siren went off. We only do five aliyahs also. And it was six hakafa when the first siren went off. And then still the six hakafa when the second siren went off. I went home. I walked in the house, and one of my sons was there, and he's always on call. And he's in his Shabbos pants with no shirt on and his phone out. I go, what's going on? He said, I don't know, but they told me to be ready to go somewhere. Not sure. And one after another, my kids, we had a bunch of the kids over for one out. And we drove him to Teddy Stadium here in Jerusalem. And then the next one was called. And next one was told to be on standby. Another one was told they'll be back to him too. And I watched these kids walk out, put on a knapsack, and walk out the door just to do their job. Just to do the job. No thank you. No, go get them. I give them each a bracha, you know, which I did every time they went in when they came out for 2 days. Here in 2 days, they are like one of the things that's kind of, is I give them a bracha every time they go in to Gaza or go north. One of my kids who actually went to Gaza for the first time, normally he's in Central Command. So a few weeks ago, he went to Gaza the first time, and he was kind of, I didn't see him. He called me up and he said, I'm about to cross the border. Give me a bracha. And he's just going to do his job. And they're not looking to be thanked. And they're not looking to be held up as heroes. They're just going to do the job of the Jewish people.
And they're that just, job is the protection of the land, the people, and all the worldwide the people, Jewish community.
And I'll even add more than that, and the free world.
Right.
The free world has lost its resolve to combat evil. So many people won't draft in America or the UK if you call on them right now. Freedom doesn't exist if you don't fight for it. It must be fought for. It must be fought for and defended.
That's why you admire the American founders.
It is why I admire the American founders.
That era, right?
That's why, you know, my grandfather spent 3 years in the Pacific in the U.S. Navy in World War II. And people who sacrifice that they can go out. And those that don't and sit back, and by the way, it's true here also, no problem saying, and I found some of the comments by the Haredi Rabbanim here. Not just, I wrote about it publicly, so it's no secret. Not only offensive, but a chil Hashem Shamayim. And many of whom are held in high esteem by segments of the population, is Chil Hashem. They don't get it. And they'd be happy to go back to the shtetl, maybe. But freedom must be fought for. And that's in the Torah. Next week, we're going to read Parshas Bamidbar. And it says, Kol Yotzei Tzava B'Yisrael. Who's counted in the census? Only people who go to fight. Because God understood that if you want to be free, and you want to be sovereign, which is critical for the Jewish people, you need to fight. So the first thing we do...
I never thought of that. Only those eligible for the draft are counted.
Only those... not only those eligible, only those who draft.
Who actually draft.
Who draft. Kol Yotzei Tzava B'Yisrael are counted in the census. The others don't count. Not just that. The Abar Benel, by the way, and the sixth Aliyah of Parshas Bamidbar says that the reason the Shevet Levi is so small is because you can't support them. And because they don't fight. And so our kids, like I said before.
As a Levi, I take that to heart.
Yeah. I pinch myself. I think these kids have taught us a lesson. This defining generation of kids have taught us all a lesson. A lesson. What matters in life and what matters for our people. What matters to the Jewish people globally.
You've seen how many of your children leave the house since October 7th?
Five.
Wow.
We had four in Gaza.
What can I say?
For many, many months.
What can I say?
Isn't my wife a hero? You know her.
I know your wife. I know your wife longer than I know you.
Aren't our daughters and daughters-in-law heroes?
Yeah. Are you
it's
kidding
like
me?
Incredible.
Your daughter-in-laws must be.
And daughters and daughters-in-law.
It's and of like, course daughters, right.
What, you know, what do we have to say to these kids other than how do we let it get to this point?
And by the way, for those in the United States listening who think it's any different now than it was 7 months ago, at the height, supposedly, of this whole thing, they're going through the same difficulties of not having their husbands around and trying to raise their children on their
own.
We
had four kids in Gaza last week. Two in Gaza and two up north, to be accurate. We had two in Gaza and two up north last week. Happens to be right now at this moment, everybody's home, but one's going back tomorrow, one's going back Sunday or Monday.
Yeah. Can't thank you enough.
No, thank me.
I could do this for the next couple hours.
So. Yeah. Well, thank you for coming and thank you for providing your platform for this conversation, but also for calling out to people to think about the future of our people and to think about where that future is. And you've built this network for a lot of years.
For 40 years, I'm saying to this audience, the future of the Jewish people is in the state of Israel. But now, it really feels like I'm accurate.
I think you're right.
To a lot of people.
I think you're right. Chazak v'ematz.
Tada rabba. Michael Eisenberg, everybody. Check out his books. Check out his WhatsApp group. Can people join your Parsha group?
Sure. If they find me on Twitter, my Twitter handle is at Mike Eisenberg.
There you go.
MikeEisenberg. And then if you go every Friday, the Dvar Torah goes up in Hebrew and English, also on Twitter and Facebook. So
you didn't do your own translation of your book, did you?
No, I did not do my own, but I did edit it myself. After it was translated.
In both languages?
No, I wrote it in Hebrew. I wrote
so
in Hebrew.
So the book was not written in English.
No, I wrote in Hebrew.
And a translator translated into English.
No, I wrote on Esther, Bereishis, Shmos, Vayikra, and Bamidbar in Hebrew.
Wow.
I used a translator to translate Esther and Bereishis, Genesis, into English already, and then I edited them both. And now I'm working on the other translations. I was actually in the middle of trying to finish up Devarim when the war hit, and now I'm like stalled.
Amazing. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Nachum.
Kol hakavod. Michael Eisenberg, everybody. If you missed any of this, check out the archive, of course, at nachumsiegel.com or on the NSN app.